Okay, good morning. Bokitov. Thank you everybody for venturing out and braving the weather. It's not actually too bad right now. Sun's shining for a few minutes. Baruch Hashem for the rain that we're getting. It's a wonderful thing. So, I promised you a few sessions on issues of kashrus. We haven't talked about kashrut issues for a little while. What I'd like to try and deal with today is the topic of gelatin, which will explain why this is a halakhic and hashgafic issue. Next week and the week after, I'd like to do a little bit about cheese and wine. Okay, getting in the mood for Purim, and I'm not bringing in any samples, sorry. If I didn't bring any for the whiskey shear, I'm not bringing anything for the cheese and wine shear. But I'd like to speak next week a little bit about cheese and issues, cheese and related issues, and then the week after that about wine. And then 3 weeks, probably 3 weeks or 4 weeks from today, it will be Tanis Esther. And we will be having a shear, please God, on Tanis Esther. And must be 3 weeks from today, mustn't it? Must be today. Yeah, 3 weeks from today is Tanis Esther. We will be having a share on a Purim-related issue. Now, yes, if I could remind people to turn their phones off, I've just been reminded to remind you. One of the tricky halakhic and hashgafic issues which we have at the beginning of every seminary year when the new girls arrive from America, from London, South Africa, is we have to try and explain to them, how does kashrut work in Israel? And first of all, we have to work out whether we understand how kashrut works in Israel, and then we can communicate to other people. But one of the difficult questions is people are asking us, well, can I eat under a rabbanut hechsher? Which is a good question, because people come with pretty clueless understandings from chutzlaretz of what the standards really are there, and certainly clueless about what the standards are here. And some people get into their heads that there's some kind of a problem with this heksher or that heksher. Certainly one of the things that I try to get people to understand from the very first minute is that you can't walk around saying that a respectable heksher is not kosher. That is just a lashon hara about the people who are the makshirim of the heksher. Okay, there are sketchy heksherim out there of, two men and a dog who have, set up on a, maybe not the dog, but whatever, just set up some kind of, that is the case. But there are responsible, respectable, mainstream heksherim out there, and certainly to say that anyone was not kosher would be a gross misrepresentation, but there are different things that different heksherim allow. And one of the key issues, at least historically, maybe not today so much, was gelatin. Because we'll see that gelatin is something that almost every responsible heksher in Chutz La'aretz takes off the menu. You will not find gelatin from non-kosher sources. Obviously, we'll talk about gelatin from kosher sources, but gelatin from regular animal bones and skins, you will not find that permitted by the OU or by Star K or by the London Basin or any of the Mahadran Hechsherim. But historically, the Rabbanut in Israel did allow gelatin from certain sources. We'll talk about what sources and we'll talk about whether they still do. And that became one of the issues when you pick up your nice-looking gloopy dessert in a restaurant. Does it or doesn't it have gelatin in it? And is that a relevant question today? So let's have a little look at this as we go through. Let's start with an interesting hashgafic beginning. I've labeled it rather cheekily, are all the best foods tray? So we'll see the answer to that appears to be no. Have a look at number one. This is from Parsha Shmini coming up in a few weeks. Zay Sachaya Asher Tochlu. These are the animals, says the Torah, that you're allowed to eat. Amalek Kodesh Baruch Hu, so God says to Moshe, Hithi Yisrael Shelo Yochlu Dvarim Raim. I'm telling you, Moshe, says God to Moshe, to tell the Jewish people that there are bad foods out there that they're not meant to be eating, and these are the foods off the menu, because they're not good for you. Says the Gemara, or actually the Midrash Tanchuma, Shelo Yitacha Yitzcha, so that your Yetzer shouldn't trick you to thinking, Loimer, and say, Ki Dvarim Tovim Asa Kodesh Baruch Hu, Lisa. All the best things God said were trade. Don't let you think that, because there actually is a good alternative for every single non-kosher food. This is a quite well-known idea, but here's the source. Amar Kodesh Baruch Hu. Kol ma she'asati lecha hitzilti lecha kenegdo. Everything that I took off the menu, there is a parallel food which is just as good, which is on the menu, and not just food. Look at this list. Asati lecha et adam. I told you you're not allowed to eat blood. But hitzilti lecha et hatchol, hatchol ve'et hakaved. I said you can eat the spleen and eat the liver. Shikulamdam. The whole thing's made of blood. Okay, there are ways to have to kasher it, but at the end of the day, there's a lot of red stuff oozing out of a lot of our meats. Don't worry. There is a kosher version of dam, which is not halachically dam, which is what to eat. Asati lecha basar chazir. I took pork off the menu, says God. But don't worry. Asati lecha lashon dag shishmo shibuta. There's a certain tongue of a fish, which is called shibuta. Shidomel chazir. Just as good as pork. Maybe even better. I'm not sure what this is exactly, but you can go away and ask your local Orthodox chef. Asati lecha eshet ach. I said that you can't marry your brother-in-law, says the Midrash here. And I know that some people, well, it depends on which perspective you're looking at, isn't it? Every sister-in-law is also a brother-in-law, right? So your husband's brother, right? This is the other way around, which is the wife of your brother. So I said, Eshed Ach is no good. He tied to the Chala Ach Amisaso, but don't worry, because after Yibum, it's okay. Okay, there's stuff that has to happen in the middle, but there's an outlet here for Eishes Ach as well. Shinema Yivama Yivala. Okay, Asati Lecha Kilayim Shatnas, and you might be thinking, oh my goodness, I'm missing out on wearing all that Shatnas that my non-Jewish friends can wear, and this deprives me of certain things in life. Says the Torah, don't worry. Asati Lecha Sadin Batzitzit. There are certain kinds of, you can have a sheet with tzitzit on it, and the tzitzit could be made of wool, which with a tchelet, which of course has to be made of wool, and the sheet can be made of linen, and you can be wearing tzitzit on a linen beged, and you can be wearing kilayim beheser. Now, of course, we don't do this today because of the whole tchelet question, and even people who think they know what tchelet is don't actually wear tchelet with linen. We had a whole shir on that. But in principle, if you're chalashing after kilayim, there's good news. Asati lecha chelev behema. Chelev, the fat, the suet of a behema is off the menu. That's why everybody's grandmas were making schmaltz all the time. Because schmaltz comes from a chicken. Okay? And schmaltz is the Jewish equivalent of what non-Jewish people use for suet. I remember I grew up very close to my grandparents, and almost everything my grandmother ever made has to contain significant amounts of schmaltz. I've no idea why, but she was always doing something with schmaltz, okay? But hitati lecha chaya. Forget about schmaltz. I allowed you the fats from a kosher chaya, from a non-domesticated animal. It's fine. So you can get that as well. The kol kach lama, why did the Torah go out of its way to say, don't worry, there's a kosher equivalent? This is chas of Yisrael, because we want to give a good reward to the Jewish people. Shem Hashamrim, it's our mitzvahs. We're all, Baruch Hashem, trying to do mitzvahs. Why should we miss out? Interesting. An interesting hashgafic idea. Yes?
I just looked it up. A shibuta is a large freshwater carp.
A large freshwater carp. So please go and pick up a freshwater carp, have a look at the tongue, and see how you get up. So let's have a look. Gelatin has come onto the mainstream of different recipes over the last few hundred years. We'll talk about how. I brought you a little Wikipedia section here. Gelatin, from the Latin gelatus, meaning stiff or frozen. And there actually is a scale, the Bloom scale, as to how stiff gelatin is, named after some fellow, Oscar T. Bloom, who I assume was Jewish, but who invented the scale in the 1920s. Gelatin is a translucent, colorless, brittle, flavorless food ingredient that is derived from collagen, obtained from various animal body parts. And that's an important first point. Which parts of the animal do they use to extract this collagen? The bones and the skins. It's almost all from bones and skins, and we'll see soon that most commercial gelatin today is made from skins and not bones, and most from pig skins. Okay? So that's an important point. It is also referred to as hydrolyzed collagen, collagen hydrolysate, gelatin hydrolysate, hydrolyzed gelatin, and collagen peptides. Fine. It is commonly used as a jelly agent in food, medication, drugs, vitamin capsules, photographic films, papers, and cosmetics. We'll talk a little bit more about the food side in a minute. Now, as I said to you, 90% of gelatin today is derived mostly from pig skins and bones, but mostly from the skins. The gelatin was not known in the time of the Gemara. It was discovered and started to be used properly in the 1400s. People started to extract it from the hooves, usually of cattle. Calf's foot jelly is a delicacy, if you can call it delicate, in certain circles. Okay? A patent was taken out in the 1750s, and after the French Revolution, just a little bit of a vignette of history, when people were really starving and there was no food in the shops, gelatin became a good substitute for quote-unquote real food, and they were giving the people, you know, to paraphrase, let them eat gelatin after the French Revolution. That was one of the things that they did. And of course, became popular in the United States in the 1800s when Jell-O was invented, and of course, Jell-O itself was patented in the 1890s. 1897, and if you want to go to Leroy, New York, if I'm pronouncing it right, you can go to the Jell-O Museum. Anyone here been to the Jell-O Museum? It's not on the tourist track in Leroy, New York. Okay, fine. So the point is that Jell-O is, every American kid knows about Jell-O, and it's gelatin is the key ingredient. So what type of products do we find gelatin in? So I brought you some examples. Now, I don't know how to pronounce this. What is it? Pcha? Pcha. Pcha. I knew that people here would... when I was a kid, they called this feshnogi, as far as I can recall. It's the same thing, right? Feshnogi, no? Galaretto, whatever. It's carbs for jelly. Obviously, gelatin is critical for that. By the way, pcha comes from Turkish, just so you know. I brought you in the footnote, something pacha kopati, leg soup. Okay, fine. Also in creamy desserts, it's wonderful in yogurts, in frostings and icings, creams, ice creams. It gives a thick consistency in mousses, whipped creams. It's used to help your sprinkles stick on the cakes. It's good for low-fat options because it's not fat, and it can be used to replace fats as well. But not just in foods. Pills often contain gelatin. Over the years, the pharmaceutical industry has been trying to work out ways, creative ways to get medication, which is often very bitter and sometimes powdery, to get people to take that in a more acceptable way. And of course, what often happens is they now put it into a gelatin cap, especially liquid medicine, which can be contained in a gel cap, and you just swallow it and it slides down easily, and the gel cap breaks down quickly and you can ingest the medicine. And this is perhaps one of the most relevant shilas as to what to do with gel caps. I asked somebody a few years ago to pick me up some melatonin in America. For some reason, melatonin is hard to get hold of in this country. You need a prescription. In America, you can buy it by the tens of thousands in CVS. But somebody brought it back for me, and they never thought to check. It was a gel cap, gelatin-containing version of the melatonin. Can I or can I not take it? What are the issues? So we'll deal with those soon. Yeah, lots of things in this country, but not melatonin. You need a prescription, as far as I'm aware. Over there, yeah, fine. You can get it in America. You can with a headshot. Candies obviously have a lot of gelatin in them, and the classic example, which gave rise to the ketubas in the 1950s, is marshmallows. Everybody knows that marshmallows is the gelatin heaven, where you need the gelatin to keep the marshmallow firm when it's been aerated, otherwise it'll just collapse. So we'll talk about marshmallows later. Vitamins, or vitamins if you wish, also important. Many of them are oil soluble, and they needed to find ways to stop the oil leaching into the vitamin, and they found a way to cover the micro capsules, if you like, of the vitamin in gelatin, so that it somehow keeps the oil from seeping into the vitamin the other way around. Immobilized enzymes, which is a little bit beyond my pay scale as to how exactly immobilized enzymes work, but I brought you a little bit of a summary there. Sometimes they need to pass food over an enzyme and keep that enzyme from washing away, and gelatin can be a good fixing agent that puts that there. And also filtering, which is not new technology. We'll see the Noda Yehuda has a tshuva, talks about filtering. But one of the things that gelatin can do is it can catch the impurities in apple juice or beer, etc., catch them and sink them to the bottom so they can be easily taken away. And most people don't like cloudy apple juice or cloudy beer, and therefore already many hundreds of years ago they worked out there was an ingredient called isinglass, which they used to put into beer, which was made from the swim bladder of a non-kosher sturgeon fish. Okay, which of course is trade, and they used to put that into beer to bring the impurities to the bottom. So these are all areas where gelatin has found its way into life. Today, I think for us, it's mostly gloopy desserts and gel cap medicines, but there are others as well. So let's have a look at the halachic issues, and with some hashkafic issues along the way. There are three issues I want to look at today. The first one is the main one, which is gelatin from a known kosher animal in fact permitted or not permitted? And we'll see five or six factors that have been debated over the last couple of hundred years. Two related questions which I want to look at the end is, let's say we get gelatin from a kosher behemoth, a kosher cow, is it fleishik or is it parav? can I put it in my milky dessert or not? And then finally, fish gelatin, which has been the substitute in most places over the last few decades, can that be mixed with meat products? Because people do not eat fish and meat together. Some people don't eat fish and milk together, actually. My daughter did Shirut Lumi, and everyone else in her apartment was Sephardi, and she was there mixing her tuna with her cottage cheese, and everyone called her the Goya. You know, she eats milk and fish together, okay? The Seder, you know, she's Ashkenazi, proud of it, and she's happy with her fish and cheese. But gelatin, fish gelatin, how does that work? So let's have a look at the issues about regular gelatin from non-kosher animals. And I brought you a reference in the footnotes here to a great article on this by Rabbi Jachter, Rabbi Chaim Jachter from Teaneck. He wrote a great article on this, and some of the material comes from there, but some from other places. There are basically six issues that we need to be aware of before we allow regular gelatin. And as I said, the Rabbanut Heksher in Israel, classically, maybe not today, we'll talk about that in a minute, allowed gelatin from non-kosher sources. Why? So the first major tzad lahati, the first major element which militates in favor of allowing gelatin, is that it's made from bones. And the question is, are bones really traits? If you have a trafe animal, are the bones really trafe as well? So let's have a look, please, at number three. The starting point is, well, yes, why shouldn't they be trafe? Look at number three. Gemara in Bukhara says, Shayotse min atameh tameh, vayotse min atahor tahor. In principle, your starting position is anything that comes out of a trafe animal is trafe, and anything that comes out of a kosher animal is kosher. So the bones from a cow, the cow could be a nevela. For example, it hasn't been shechted properly, which would be, obviously, every cow from a non-Jewish production line is nevela. They're not shechted. It could be a trefer, if it's from a shechita house, but they opened it up and found it as a trefer. Or it could be from a non-kosher species, a behemoth, a mare, a horse, a pig, etc. Yes?
What about dvash?
What about dvash? Well, we had a whole shiur on dvash about a year and a half ago, and I will mention dvash in a minute about something else, but I would refer you to the shiur. It's on my website. We had a whole discussion about dvash, but that's a good question. Yes. Same question. Okay? So that's a very sweet question, but you can look at the shiur and get to the bottom of that. So, in principle, everything that comes out of a trace animal is trace. So over the page to page three. However, when the Torah prohibits nevela, in Parsha Shmini, it says in number four, Mibsaram lo tochelu. You may not eat from their basar. Basar. Ubinivlatam lo tigau. And you may not touch their nevela. So what's the basar? So Chazal in the Sifra, which is the halachic medrash on Vayikra, say in number four as follows. Mibsaram. Why didn't say Mibsaram? Velo min ha'atamot. This doesn't include, this prohibition doesn't include the bones. V'lo min agidim, all the sinews. V'lo min aflafim, all the hooves. They are not called basar. And therefore, they are not prohibited in the same way as the rest of a nevela. Question is, how are they? Are they prohibited at all? So if you open the Rambam, look at the Rambam in 6. The Rambam says, yes, they are prohibited, but not as prohibited as the basar. Look at number 6. Ha'oichel min nevela v'treifa. Someone who eats from a nevela or a treifa, says the Rambam. Or min behem of a chaya tameim, or from a non-kosher animal. Min ha'or, if you eat the skin of the animal. Umin atzamot, or the bones. Umin agidim. Umin akarnaim, from the karnaim, from the horns. Okay? Umin atzlafim, or from the hooves. You eat not regular parts, non-fleshy parts of the animals. Look what he says. Afal pi shehu asur, it is prohibited. Harize patur, but you are exempt. You don't get malchus if you eat from them. Because they're not really edible. They do not join together. If you eat a little bit of flesh and a little bit of hoof or horn or skin or whatever it is, they don't add together to make the kazayit, to make you liable for malchus. Now, when he says they're asur, but you're patur, what does he mean? So pashtus, he means they're rabbinically prohibited. That's normally the language used for a rabbinic prohibition. There are those, Rav Aaron Kotler, who we'll see soon a lot more of, who wanted to say, no, no, no. The Rambam says, actually, they are prohibited on a Torah level if they are edible. It's only if they're inedible that they're prohibited rabbinically, and we'll see how you can make bones edible soon, but they seem to be prohibited on some level. Which is interesting, because this is the honey point I was going to make. If you look in Tosfos and the Rosh, they raise a question about honey, but not the honey itself, but the little black bits which you sometimes found floating in or stuck inside your honey. Now today, in commercial production, they get rid of those bits. But if you were looking at, but in honeycomb, they don't necessarily. If you buy honeycomb, the solid honey, there are occasionally little bits of black stuff inside the honeycomb. Now you may not want to know what they are, but they are the proverbial bee's knees. Okay? They are the little bits of bee legs that they didn't manage to get out of the honey. And Tosfos in the Middle Ages asks, how can we eat these? People eat these. People eat honeycomb, and they can't get the black bits out. They're tray for bits of bees. Look at number seven. Yes.
But that raises the issues of strawberries in this day.
I'm not getting into strawberries. If I get into strawberries, I'll never get out of strawberries. Okay?
But the best here is to eat them if you mash them.
Good, good. If you mash them. The problem is with strawberry jam, the heter to mash them is you really can't see any bits of any insect that might have been there or might not have been there. It's all jam. With the honey, you can see it. And you can't say something is bottle if you can see it. Once you can see it, it's not bottled by anything. You can see it's there. So he says, how can we eat them even though we see them? Look at number seven. Yesh l'tmoa. It's a very big surprise. Achshav, heich anu oichlin dvash dvayrim. How can we eat bee honey? V'haloi ragle hadvayrim muravin b'dvash. The legs of the bees are mixed in with the honey. We can see them. The afagav, the honey pagam, even though they don't taste nice. Mikol nakam hasheret atzmoi de'ifgam mitzvah l'kol ha'omim. There is an idea of noisin tam livgam, which an insect which doesn't taste nice, if it gives off taste from it, then that taste doesn't prohibit. The following story once happened to my wife. I never forget the scream that I heard from the kitchen. We were living in London. What had happened is she'd emptied up some frozen beans into a pan, okay, and put them on to boil, whatever, frozen beans from the freezer. She came back 2 minutes later, looked in the pan, and there was a snail in the pan with the frozen beans. Okay, as I said, I remember the scream. Somehow or other, it got into the frozen beans, and the question was now, the beans she was not asking such a Shiloh on, which is like she's not going to eat the beans, but is the pan tray? And the answer was, no, the pan is not tray, it's noisein tam lifgam. Any taste given off from the snail is bad, halachically, it's not tasty in that sense. But so Tosfos, but an actual bit of snail, or bee, or whatever it is, you don't say noisein tam lifgam. That's mamash a little bit of tray. So he says, "Lachein nira l'Rabbeinu Tam." He quotes Rabbeinu Tam, "Devadai ragli hadvarim kaven da at samois ba'almaninu." Since they are just the bones, mutarim. Bee bones are apparently okay. And the Rosh says a similar thing. Number eight, "Heich anu oichlim advash." How do we eat honey? "V'halo ragli azvuv muravim bo." Same question. The legs of the bees are inside. The higher Amar Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam used to say, "Af yishar boy ragle hazov," even if the legs are still in, or knafim, okay, or the wings of the knafayim is the wings, but the kanaf of the bees if they're in, okay, einu chashuv kasheret. They are not called a sheret. Why? Afar ba'alma. They're just afar. It's just. I don't know. Dust. It's not real. There's nothing real there. It just crumbles away. So if this is the case, is there a machlokas here between the Rambam and Tosfos and the Rosh? Does the Rambam say the bones are drabonon, but Tosfos and the Rosh say the bones are actually mutter? And some people want to look at it that way. And Rav Cheskel of Ramsky, who was one of the matirim on gelatin, we'll get to him soon, and Rav Chaim, in practice he wasn't matir, but in principle he was matir. Rav Chaim Ozin Levinsky was matir in practice as well. He said, basically, they said as follows, that actually there is potentially a reconciliation, that maybe hard bones, everyone agrees, are osser, but are amuta rather, but soft bones are osser. Maybe there's no machlokas here at all. Maybe the Rambam and Tosfos and the Rosh agree that the hard, brittle bones, like the bee bones, they're okay. But the soft bones, when there's actually moach, where there's actually some kind of, what do they call it?
Marrow
in the bones, okay? Maybe that's where the bones are osser. So there's no machlokas. Rav Aaron Kotler of Moshe Feinstein said, no, even hard bones are prohibited, and that becomes very important, because gelatin was classically made from hard bones. And if you want to say that the hard bones are okay, and that's what Tosfos is talking about, and the Rambam really agrees, then that will get you further towards a heter for gelatin. But if you want to say, no, hard bones are even prohibited, there's really a machlokas here, and we're passing like the Rambam, then we're going to be in a little bit of trouble, because even if it's not doraisa, it's still osa. even from a half bone. So that's the first question. Is there a machlokas or does everyone agree here? But it may be irrelevant because in practice the gelatin comes today from skins, not from bones, the commercially produced gelatin. If you look here in number 9, the Mishnah in Chulin says, Elu she'oroseihem kibsaram. The following animals, actually their skins have the same halacha as their flesh because they're very soft and they can be easily eaten. And look at this list. Or ha'adam, now hopefully no one's eating people's skins, but or chazir shel yishuv, and the skin of a domesticated pig. Rabbi Yehuda Omer af or chazibar, even a wild boar or pig, but one way or the other, apparently cow skins and pig skins are different. So it's not going to help us. This discussion about bones is really not going to help that much, because lemaisa, most of the gelatin on the market comes from skins, and come from pig skins. And therefore, and pig skins are like basara, and therefore we can basically ignore everything we've been talking about, because even if there is a heter for bones, for hard bones, it's not going to apply lemaisa. And I spoke to various rabbonim from the rabbanut, and they said even when the rabbanut allowed gelatin, they never allowed it from skins. They only allowed it from hard bones, and that, as we can see, is part of the machlokas here. Now, you might ask, yeah, but one second, the amount of gelatin is so tiny, surely it's bottle of shishim. You can't say that there's more than a 60th of the gelatin in the food. And the answer is it won't help. Why will it not help? This is the principle in Hilchos Kashrus. The gelatin is a ma'amid. Look in number 10. Aval ha-ma'amid, says the Shulchan Aruch, if something is a gelling agent or a fixing agent, like in cheese, for example, the rennet in cheese, ha-ma'amid ba'or kibat tevela, if you use as a fixing agent the stomach of a trape animal, we'll get to cheese next week with kosher animals, the trafer or a trafer, or the hematomea, or a non-kosher species, asurba kol shehu. You can't do it at all. Why not? Says the Ramah, mishum da davah ha'asa ba'atmai, something intrinsically prohibited, umamid, and you use it as a ma'amid, as a gelling or a fixing agent, afilu ba'elef, lo gafel. It's not even a bottle ba'elef. It doesn't matter. An elef could be even more than elef. It's an interesting question. When it says it's never bottled, does that mean it's never, ever? We get this conversation about people dropping breadcrumbs in the Kinneret on Pesach. Yeah? When they say that chometz on Pesach isn't bottled, afilu be'elef, does that mean like afilu be'milyon, afilu be, you know, elef milyon, or what? That's a conversation for then, but not for now. But in principle, gelatin is a gelling agent, it's a mamid, and it won't help that it's bottled with shishim. So that won't help us at all. Yes? Because it's not a gelling agent. Right. Right. Because it doesn't make anything hard, you mean? Right.
It doesn't have a taste either.
Well, we'll get to the issue of taste now. The second issue, so let's just summarize the first issue. The first way of maybe giving a heter to gelatin is to say, well, it comes from the bones. And bones are not the same as meat. So A, it doesn't really come from the bones anymore. But even if it did come from the bones, we'll see the machlokas, the Rambam and the Tosfos and the Rosh, and it could be the Rambam prohibits bones, even hard bones, and it won't help. The second issue, top of page 4. Panim chadashos. What is panim chadashos? So you're going to say, why are we talking about sheva brachos? And the answer is, we're not talking about sheva brachos. Panim chadashos bo lekam means when something has been transformed into a completely new item, maybe it loses its identity in its previous Gilgul, if you like. Let's have a look at this. So here we need to look at the question of musk. What is musk? So musk is an ingredient that you find in expensive perfumes. It comes from the sweat gland of a male deer. Now you may not want to go and buy any more expensive perfume now, in which case, good for you, you know, because you'll save some money. Cheap perfume doesn't have any musk in it. But expensive perfume has the sweat gland of the deer in it, and people apparently used to eat it as an ingredient as well. Now, what's the deal with this liquid that you squeeze out of the sweat gland? Now, leaving aside the issues of how you get the sweat gland, because what they actually used to do in hunting practice is just, you know, rip it out of the live deer, which is probably Adam in a chai anyway, or Basam in a chai of some kind. But let's assume you shechted it, you did everything properly, and now you want to eat this liquid. Let's have a look at the Rosh here, number 11. Yesh amrim sheha musk, hu zeyat chaya. It's like the sweat of this wild animal. V'nachon yoteh shecha yeduahi, sheyesh la chatoteret, v'tzavara. There's this particular animal that has like a bump on its neck. Umitkabet sham tchila ke'in dam. And it gathers together, it initially makes it from blood. But this blood goes through different processes and it turns into musk. Now, of course, everything inside the body starts off as blood or is milk, is made from bodily fluids with whatever. But he said this musk starts off as blood. Can you eat it or is it blood? So look what he says. Rav Zecharia Levi, okay? Zerachia Levi. He says here, the Balamor, as follows. He says you can't eat it. It started as blood. It's still blood. Rabbeinu Yonah turns around and says, "Perish the Efshar Liten Bot Ham Lahasir." I can give you a reason to say it's okay. The Loimer de Pusha Baalma Hu. It is just an excretion. It is just a secretion. It is not blood anymore. The Afal Pishim Itchila Hayadam. Even though it started off as blood, like Hashin and Lahachi, we're not worried about it anymore. The Batar Hashta Azlina. We don't look at what it was. We look at what it is. And it's gone through a complete transformation. And on that basis, a number of key poskim, Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, which we'll come back to again, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, Rabbi Avadia Yosef, who are all the classic matirim for gelatin, say, look, it may have come from bones. It may have come from skins. But it was processed so much and then reconstituted, it's now something completely different. It doesn't have any relation to what it was before, and on that basis they want to be matir gelatin as a panim chadasha. So it's a completely new thing. Yes.
So then they would say it's okay from the drinkables too?
Yes, in theory that would be okay from anything. Because once you say that it's a totally new item, I don't care where it came from. The discussion that we had before about bones and skins was assuming it still has the identity somehow, and we want to call it a bone and not a skin, because bones are better than skin. Here it'll make no difference, because it's completely reconstituted. Rav Abramsky rejects this completely. Dan Abramsky, we'll see, had an important shuva on this, which is printed in the Tzitz Eliezer. Just want to see a few words from Dan Abramsky, we'll get back to him soon. Number 12. Dava Boror, he says, it's quite clear to me, who Asher had gelatin, and he gives you the Yiddish spelling of gelatin, where J is spelled Dalad Zayin Shin. Okay? Gelatin. Okay? Gelatin anasim atzamot eino yitzira chadasha. It is not a new thing. It's not. Shenishtana mechome arishon. You can't say change from the original thing. El chome chadash. To do the chadash legamri. Al yidei emtsaim kimiim. You can't say chemical processes have transformed it. No. The gelatin who oisa chama asma sheyesh about some of the yikaram. It's the same thing. It just came out of the bones. The chol ha'im saim ha'kimiyim and all of the chemical processes shemishtam shimbahem that you use in the process of tatiyat ha'gelatin in making the gelatin einon balim ala lahafrid shah chamarim sheyesh about some of. It's not there to change it. It's just there to separate it, to get it out of the bones, to get other things out as well. Mechomer ha'gelatin. So it's interesting. It's almost like a machlokas about the metzias as to what's going on with this chemical process. Am I changing what was into something new, or am I just extracting it from what was there before? Okay, which is, or maybe it's a machlokas in halacha as to what's called a change. That could be more of a lomdish kind of machlokas. It's not just that they're talking about what happened. It's that is it a difference that makes a difference in halacha? And this, therefore, the machmirim rejected completely as a tzad lahasir. The main issue there is number three, which we're getting into now, which is the following: gelatin goes through a stage in which it's completely inedible. It's turned into a powder, which is not edible on any level, and then it's reconstituted into something kosher, into something edible, rather. Do we say that something that was edible became inedible and then was once again made edible, do we say that's still food? And that's the key machlokas, really, that's going on, and that's where the marshmallow tshuva came in. Yes?
What is inedible?
Something
edible? Damages?
No, not necessarily something. I mean, so lots of things which are edible also damage us. Sugar to a diabetic or high cholesterol or whatever. It's something which normal people wouldn't eat. And we'll see, we'll also nifsal ma'achilat kelev, what would a dog eat? And we'll have to define how normal does a dog have to be before we decide if it's a dog that matters. We'll get to that in a minute. So let's have a look at this question. It's a bit technical, but it's very important. This is the key gelatin question. Again, what was edible, and then inedible, and then re-edible, if that's a word, is that a problem? Number 13. Lo yitochlu kol nevela. It says, do not eat good nevela. What should I do with the nevela? Give it to your local non-Jewish neighbors. They'll eat it. Sell it to a non-Jew. Do business with it. You don't have to throw it in the garbage. Send it to the non-Jews. They'll eat it. There's nothing wrong with it. From here you see the Avodah Zarah, going to Avodah Zarah, says in number 14, Kol haru'uya leger kuri nevela, she'en ru'u leger ein kuri nevela. It's only called a nevela if a non-Jew would eat it. That's what the Pasuk said. Give it to your non-Jewish neighbors and they'll eat it. If my non-Jewish neighbors wouldn't eat it because it's not edible, then it's not nevela. That everybody agrees upon.
What do you mean by not edible? Do you mean the person doesn't usually like it?
No, it means...
What do you actually mean? It's
not edible to a human.
Non-digestible.
Okay, well, I don't know about digestion, but
if... We're talking about edible.
I think edible means no normal person would eat it, even al yedei hadchak. Okay? Meaning there are things which are, I don't like bread which is stale. Okay? But it's edible. People don't normally eat it, but it's edible. It's not called inedible. But bread which is moldy is inedible. It's not roi la'achila afila al yidei chak. No one would eat it even, I mean, obviously someone who's on a desert island, God forbid, and they haven't eaten for a month, obviously may eat it. That's not the point. But normal people wouldn't eat it even if they were pressed to eat it. Okay? I don't know about digestion. Different people digest in different ways. Have a look in Pesachim. The Gemara in Pesachim wants to raise the question, well, does it have to be inedible by a dog? Or just a person? So he says, Hapatcha ibsha, bread that has gone moldy. Okay? The nifsa mele'echol la'odah. And a person wouldn't eat it. The hakelev yachol la'ochla, but a dog would eat it. Then he says, Matamitumas oichlim kebeta. It is considered on a certain level to be a food. The nitzrefet has to be burned before Pesach, etc. And the halacha for Pesach is, in number 16, in Shulchan Aruch, chomet shenitapesh koidem zman isura. A piece of real chomet, a real piece of bread, which actually went moldy before the zman isra, the nitzal ma'achilas hakelev, and it is no longer edible to a dog, or it was burnt in a fire, kodim zmanu, v'nechrach ad she'en ro'el kalev, and it's burnt to the point that it's not edible by a dog, mutar l'kaimo Pesach. You're allowed to keep it on Pesach if it's not edible by a dog. Now, it's very interesting. Here, the relevant question is not what's edible to a person. In other areas other than chometz, I don't care whether the dog would eat it or the dog wouldn't eat it. Is it edible to a person? And the Bir Halacha makes it very clear in number 17, the Afa Gavda Bashari Surim, when it comes to anything other than chometz, kol she'enu ruya la'achilat adam mutar. Even if a dog would eat it, as long as people don't eat it, wouldn't eat it, then that's good enough for a regular Surim. It's only by chometz that we need an extra level of inedibility. Why? Shani chomet is different. Shafilo ainu roi lachila adam lachilat adam roi lachametz bo, meaning saor shmarim is inedible as well, and yet it's clearly chomet, and therefore you need a higher level of inedibility for chomet than you do for regular things. By the way, just in terms of what would a dog eat, there's a very interesting machlokas. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach came out many years ago and said that soap needs a hechsher for Pesach. Why? Because soap is edible to a dog. Ah, my dog doesn't eat soap. So they said, that's because you spoilt your dog, and you give your dog food from expensive supermarkets, and now your dog is a mufunak, and of course he doesn't eat soap. But a regular dog eats soap, that's what dogs eat. Okay? And therefore, soap needs a hechsher. It's ruy lachilas kalim. Okay? Rav Soloveitchik, famously, in the 1970s, took a very different view. There was an anecdote there from a shir. Many people can repeat this anecdote that the Rav Soloveitchik said toothpaste does not need a hechsher for Pesach. Why? Because it's not roi la'achilas kalev. So somebody went home and did an experiment, and they gave their dog toothpaste. And he came out next day to the shir and he said, Rav, the dog eats toothpaste. My dog eats toothpaste. And therefore, toothpaste is roi la'achilas kalev and needs a hechsher. So Rav Soloveitchik says, your dog is meshuggah. And basically, he said, I don't fix halacha because of your meshuggah nahunz. Because it's not about, and there's an interesting machlok, it's not about what the dog eats, according to this view. It's about how you relate to the food. Do you relate to this food as animal food? Even not as human food, but as animal food. If you relate to it as animal food, then it has a status of food on some level. And therefore, no one relates to toothpaste or soap as animal food. The other view was saying, well, no, I actually want to know what the dog eats and what the dog doesn't eat. So that may be part of the machlokes as to why you end up with hasherim on some very strange products on Pesach, and other people say you don't need it, other people say you do need it. Maybe it depends on how you relate to the dog. But one thing is for sure. When it comes to other foods, I don't care about dogs, it's all about people. Go over the page to page 5, people, please. The Ramah says, number 18, Or Hakeba, okay? There's a skin, there's the skin of a stomach of a cow. The Bamim Molchim Oto, sometimes they salt this cow stomach. Umiyavshin Oto, and they dry it out. The Nasa Ka'et, and it's basically completely inedible. It's like eight, it's a piece of wood. Umiyavshin Oto Chalav, and then they fill it up with milk. That's not a problem. Musa, it's fine. The ma'achashin is yabdesh. Havika eight ba'alma. Once it's dried out, it's like a piece of wood. The ein bolachluchit basar. It doesn't have any moisture in it. Once something's been dried, desiccated, dehydrated, then it's not a problem. The shach applies this, interestingly, to saffron. Saffron was made by non-Jews and dried out, and occasionally saffron had bits of dried out meat in it. Now, I don't know why they put the meat in the saffron. Maybe there was a reason. I'm not sure if it was a taste reason, but the shach here says, even if they make saffron with these bits of meat in it, I don't care because the meat has dried out. Whatever meat there was is now just basically eight, and he brings this Ramah, and he says, it's not a problem, you can eat it. And in number 20, he says, V'asa yesh gam kem lefamim karkum ratuv. Karkum is the saffron. Even though you sometimes find that it gets wet, the lach and moist, and it kind of rehydrates a little bit, and this is where it's important for us. I don't care, because it was originally completely dried, and even if it gets wet a little bit and becomes more edible, once it's inedible, it's inedible. And many 19th century poskim took this view. You can see already why it's becoming relevant to gelatin. What about cochineal? What about, am I pronouncing it right? Made from ants. Red from little red ants. There is a famous red food coloring, and the Pitzchei Tshuva brings this up in number 21. When I grew up, they used to say you can't eat the red Smarties, okay? Because the red Smarties have got cochineal in them. I don't know if that's still the case, or they get it from other places, okay? But some stuff with red flavoring in it, red coloring in it, comes from this insect. Look at the Pitzchei Tshuva, number 21. He quotes another tshuva, shekasa v'tzolaim, adumim, these little red worms, shemiyav shem oisa, they dry them out, v'tzolaim, and they use them for coloring, okay? V'mazen korim mashke, yesh, whiskey, whatever it is, musa. I don't mind if it's fine, gam ken mitamza. The same reason, they were turned into inedible powder, I don't care if you've made them edible again. Once it's inedible, then that's the end of the discussion. Once it's inedible, then it doesn't matter anymore. The Note of Yehuda takes this view. He talks about the gelatin used, or the surgeon used as the swim bladder of the surgeon used to filter the beer. He says, don't care. Even if it's wet again, because you put it in the beer, it was inedible. Once it's inedible, then there's no problem. The Orach HaShulchan takes exactly the same view in number 22. You can read it in your own time. He says, even if it becomes rehydrated, then it is a no problem. The Prima Gadim, however, in the Chasam Sofer said no. The Chasam Sofer, let's read two lines of the Chasam Sofer. He says, fine, if it's inedible, it's inedible. But once it's edible again, so then it's food. Look at what he says. Hine ein nir lahamsi hetza. I have no way to find a hetza here. Bipnei shahor kvar nasa yavishkeit. Just because the skin was dried out. Shani hasam, it's very different here. Sheomedit kach biyushuvosa. If it's still standing in its dried out, desiccated state, then I understand. Masha'ein kein hach, which is not the case here, shechozeret umitrachechet al yidei hamashkim. Once you rehydrate it and put more liquid back in, dinok basar mamash, then it becomes just like meat. V'zeh pashot lifi aniyasaiti. Why do I care if it went through an inedible phase? If it's edible now, it's considered to be edible, and there is nothing else to talk about. And on that basis, the whole approach to gelatin, where he went through an inedible phase, the poskim who took a more stringent issue on this brought this Chasam Sofer. Go on to page 6, and let me summarize the approaches to this. The lenient positions on gelatin were basically of Chaim Ozer Grudzinski. He was in Europe before the war. Rav Svi Pesach Frank, ditto. Now, Rav Avadia Yosef is a more modern posek on this, but he takes a more lenient line, and Rav Valdenberg, as I mentioned. But the main tumors on this in the 1960s were Rav Aaron Kotler, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Yosef Henkin, Rav Eliyahu Henkin. How did that come about? Because the manufacturer of marshmallows said, I want to have a hesher on my marshmallows. And therefore, the Rav Amashir of the company, Rav Nachum Tzvi Kornmail, I don't know who he was, but he put the shayla to these three Rabbonim, Rav Kotler, Rav Moshe Feinstein, and Rav Eliyahu Henkin. Can we or can we not use gelatin from non-kosher sources in our products? And all three of them said no, but for different reasons. Rav Aaron Kotler said, it's absolutely trade. There's nothing to talk about. Rav Moshe Feinstein said, I'm not sure. It's a suffix. It's quite possibly trade, and therefore don't use it. And we'll see that suffix becomes important later for gel caps and medication. And Rav Henkin said, maybe if it's made from hard bones, maybe then you could be matter it, but he didn't like it. And he felt that it should definitely not be used. And therefore, based on those three tshuvas, Rav Kotler, Rav Feinstein, and Rav Henkin, that's where all the American hechsherim come from and say, there's nothing to talk about. You will not get a heter for gelatin anywhere in any of the mainstream hechsherim in America. Of course, you see the people who were matter are much more Israeli-focused. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, and Rav Avadi Yosef. And that's why the Rabbanut classically took more of a lenient position on this, which we'll get to soon, because the Israeli poskim did not take the same view as Rav Kotler, Rav Feinstein, and Rav Henkin. Okay, that's the third issue. The fourth issue is achshavei. And again, these are all good things to talk about before Pesach, because they become relevant. What is achshavei? Achshavei is, what if I take something inedible, but I decide to eat it anyway? Because I'm weird. Can the fact that I'm weird make it into food? Have a look at number 24. Amar Rav Meir. Interesting question in Zorim. Af ana nami tanin, kainem ishti neinit li, I make a neder, says this source, that my wife may not have any benefit from me, im achalti hayom, if I ate anything today. So now we want to know, oh, did you eat anything today? The achal, and we investigate, and it turns out he did eat. What did he eat? Nevelis, Vetrefus, and Shkotzim, and Ramotim. Okay? So I don't know if his wife is interested anyway in having anything to do with it, but he made a neder, my wife can have no benefit to me if I ate, and this is what he's been eating all morning. Hari ishtu asurala. His wife is prohibited. He ate. Ah, the Gemara said, but these are not considered foods. Kevandim ikara achal, since he ate first, the hada ishtabale, and then he made the shvua, chashuvi achshavei. He shows that they were real foods. Meaning he didn't just eat them because of the shvua. If he just ate them because of the shvua, maybe he's just making a point because he's a dafkanik. But it turns out he ate them before he made the shvua, so he obviously likes eating this stuff. Says Rashi, why is it achshavei? Ba'achilato v'gila et atzmo al atzmo she'enu katmen. He showed that he doesn't mind eating them, therefore they are for him considered to be food. And that's why the Mishnah Berurah brings, 26, on the halacha about ruined chometz, where we said if a chometz is not edible by a dog, and even if no dog would eat it under any circumstances. Says the Mishnah Berurah, look here in number 26, for who has in the mutzah bahana, you can get benefit from this chometz if it's completely inedible before Pesach. Aval ba'achila asur. But you can't eat it. Why? Midrabbono. It's a rabbinic prohibition. Ad achal Pesach, you have to wait till after Pesach. Da'af agav da'achila she'en ru'uyahi, even though it's not really edible, so why am I worried? Da'anivsa lakol, it's completely pasulim, and it's completely inedible. Mikol makam kevan shehu roitz le'echol asur da'achshavik. Since he chose to eat it, you like eating moldy bread. Okay? So you can't eat moldy bread on Pesach. Because achshavei, you have turned it into real food. V'dafke b'zeh da'achshavei. That's only when you ate it on purpose. Aval im nafal mimela chometz zeh shenifshal machila kalev v'tocha machal. But if chometz, which was completely inedible, accidentally fell into your food, afilu rak b'ruboi, even if it's only a bottle b'roiv, ein lasso, then that's fine. Because it's not really chometz. We're only going to say that it's osa because you have now treated it like food. So what are we going to say about gelatin? Let's say the gelatin is completely inedible. And let's say we don't even care if it's made re-edible again by rehydrating it. We still take the lenient view and say, it's inedible when it was inedible, once inedible, always inedible. The fact that you now choose to eat it, do we say, aha, achshavei. I don't care if it's inedible. You eat it. That means it's food. So it's awesome. Or do we turn around and say no? So if Aaron Kotler said,
that achshava is a problem. Even if you say it's inedible, then it's not. It doesn't help because you're eating it. Right? Again, Rav Sipes, like Frank, Rav Chaim Oizer said, no, achshava only relates to the actual pure trade product. It doesn't apply if you mix it in things. That's why he said that the bee's knees were okay. Why do we say achshavei? Okay, so Shkoyah, first that says the bee's knees are just like dust. But you eat them. If you eat them, that shows that you're... No. You can see here that anything mixed in with something else is obviously not a problem of achshavei. Rabbi Aaron Kotler said, no, the knees of the bees are okay because you didn't put them in. You didn't mix them in on purpose. You just can't get them out. Okay, here when you're putting gelatin into the product, you can't compare that to the case of the legs of the bees because you're actively adding it. If you're adding it and you're eating it, it's achshavei. Yes, sir.
We seem to be learning again
good, but you're eating the gelatin. You can say some people are meshuggah, but if you're eating the gelatin, what does that say about you and me? We're also eating it. Here in this case, it's not just meshuggah people eat gelatin. Everybody eats gelatin.
Yeah, but we're eating sandwich. Most 99%
of people
don't eat.
Good. 99% of people wouldn't eat gelatin in its raw, inedible state. But now that you've made it into a food, regular people do eat it again. So I don't care, he's saying, if you say that it's inedible. Everybody eats it, so it's not inedible. The mice say it's edible, and therefore they answer it. The last point that Rav Kotler makes, I'll just quickly deal with, is the issue of, he said it's a bit like yeast. Yeast is prohibited because even though it's completely inedible, it makes other food edible. It makes other food fluffy, etc. So too, he says, gelatin might be in the same category because even though it might be inedible, it's a facilitator, and he wants to compare it to the yeast. Bottom line, all of the American poskim said it's off. Many of the Israeli poskim were more open to say it was mutter for the reasons that we said. It was made from the bones, and it was an inedible, and even if it was reconstituted, it's still we don't say achshavei, etc. Rav Abramsky has a very interesting thing to say, and anyone who knows the background of what was life like in London in the 1940s, 50s, in terms of Rav Abramsky's relationship with the less religious Jewish community there, it's very interesting. You can read, I'd recommend strongly, and there was a review of this in the latest edition of Tradition Journal. There was a biography of Rav Hertz, which was written a few years ago, called The Wars of the Lord. And a lot of that biography deals with Rav Hertz's relationship with Sir Robert Whaley Cohen, okay, which was rocky at all times, and his relationship with Dinah Abramsky. And it's very often in English rabbinic politics, the relationship between the chief rabbi and the head of the Beis Din is often the one which is most interesting, whether it was Rav Hertz and Dinah Abramsky, Rav Jacobovitz and Dan Erentroy, etc. Maybe just because I'm English, I'm interested in these things. But I want you to see what Dinah Abramsky says in number 27. Dinah Abramsky was open in principle to be matir. He didn't accept the reasons that it was really osser. But he said, I'm not going to be matir. I'm going to say it's osser anyway. Look why. Look at 27. They had the gelatin. Everybody thinks that gelatin is osa. You ask the man in the street, the woman in the street, what do you think of taking pig bones and sending them into gelatin? Kosher or not kosher? Oh, no, Rabbi, that can't be kosher. Okay? There's nothing more obvious and known than this. Everybody knows it comes from trade things. There are people who are less educated who might say that maybe it's only the edible bits, the marrow of the bones. But the ein ze pachat shav. It's not a ridiculous concern to say. If we do say that gelatin is mutter, this will only strengthen the ignorant view, which is so popular in our generation, whether on purpose or by accident, the rabbis can do whatever they like. They make it up as they go along. They just stick labels on the food and charge money. You know, where there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way. You say however you want to say it, okay? And that was a later phrase, obviously. But it, he said, Rabbi Abramsky said, if you tell the regular, you know, Joe Cohen on the street, okay, that gelatin is kosher, he'll say, well, Rabbi, if gelatin is kosher, then anything is kosher. Because everyone knows that gelatin is straight. Right? So he says, I'm not, and I actually, I completely understand where he's coming from here. But al kugoyin zeh nema b'yuma, and things like that, the Gemara already talks about, al titnu makom l'tzadokim l'rodoy, don't give room to the tzadokim, to the Sadducees, to have an even more of a negative attitude. Sheyomer l'fi ritzayinam hei mo'isim akol, because the Sadducees say the rabbis do whatever they like. U'mihashmainu sha'afiru d'varim ha'mutarim kugoyin eino, and therefore even things which might technically be muta, u'kudom alehem, okay, ha'musurim la'am ha'aretz, which are over, if you hand them over to the hoi poloi, Ain Adam Rashai Lahoy Rizlahem Hekta. You're not allowed to say it's Mutter. Eliyachmir Aleim Le'isam. Which is very interesting. Would you say the same thing today? Or would you turn around today and say lots of people are much more educated now than they used to be? People know more about, people go to Shiurim, people do Daf Yomi, people go online, people do, or do you say no, the average Jew in the pew is still very ignorant. Ignorant and arrogant. A dangerous combination. Okay? Or do you not? Rav Abramsky clearly took this view, and I think we understand, and he took views on other things as well. Porging. You know, taking a nikur, where people were doing it, housewives were doing it, in their own kitchens. And he said, this is a disaster. You can't do that. Do you sell meat which has not been kashered? All these kind of questions, or do you only sell kashered meat? And I'm sure that I saw things going on in different kitchens that people thought they knew what they were doing. They were pretty clueless. And maybe this approach is the right approach. I'm not sure, but I just wanted to bring this because this is an interesting hashgafic point. Four last points. The contemporary position is very clearly that you won't find a heter for gelatin anywhere but Israel, but in Israel will you? Now, I spoke to Rav Zev Weitman, who is the Rabbi Machshir of Tznuva. He also sits next to me in Shul. And I said, does the Rabbanut still allow gelatin? And he says, no, it does not. And I get conflicting views on this. Certainly the Bahadran Hechsherim in Israel never allowed gelatin from non-kosher sources. But he says already for many years now, the regular Rabbanut Hechsher will not permit gelatin. So I heard that from him. You heard that from me. Go and check it out and see if other people agree. But that is what I'm being told now, that gelatin is a question of the past and not a question of the present, even in the Rabbanut Hechsher. Fine. Three last points. Point number one. Gel cap medication is less problematic according to everybody. Because we, according to almost all poskim, we do not say achshavei on medication. Even if you were to say that, even if it's inedible, the fact that you eat it makes it osur. Medication, you're not eating it. You're not relating to it as food. The only reason you're swallowing it is because it's got some kind of magic quality inside of it that will somehow make you better. And therefore, you don't relate to it as food, therefore you don't say achshavei. So almost all poskim will say that the position on gel cap medication is less problematic. Now, it may still be preferable because the Ramah says where you can get a completely kosher without any shilas alternative, you should. The question is, how far do you need to go to get a gel cap, a non-gel cap medication? And Rav Herschel Schechter says you can take a gel cap medication even for a minor ailment if there is no other alternative easily available. Meaning if you have two things in the cupboard, one is a gel cap medication and one is a non-gel cap medication, and they're both as effective, so then you should take the non-gel cap medication. But if you can't get hold of something other than gel caps, or if the gel caps are much more effective for the particular illness or ailment than you have, then I think many, many poskim will be makel on that, and maybe Rav Aaron Kotler wouldn't in that sense, but even if you say that it's a suffix gelatin, this could be a sveker, which I put in the footnotes here. Two last points. Gelatin from kosher meat. Gelatin from kosher meat, of course, you can make that. You can take the hides, and you can kasher them, and you can make kosher gelatin. Take out all the nevelas, take out all the trephus, and you can make kosher gelatin. The problem is it's very expensive, because if you think about it, what they have to do to go through that process, normally a good hide, they don't turn it into gelatin. They sell it off as a hide, and therefore it's very expensive, but it is possible, and you can use it, and according to almost all poskim, it's paraf. It is not fleishik, and therefore you can use it with milchic products, and there are people who use that. But the classic go-to is usually fish gelatin. Now, historically, fish gelatin was not very good, and therefore it didn't really work very well. Now it's much better, the way it's processed and manufactured, and according to all post-game, fish gelatin from a kosher fish, is definitely kosher. Even if we're worried that trace of fish skins may have been mixed in somewhere along the way, then we can usually assume that they weren't, and that's not such a problem. Can you eat it with meat? Then yes. For many reasons I put on the sheet, even people who will not eat fish with meat, and there are different approaches to what extent we separate fish and meat. We do not eat fish and meat together. Then most people are are lenient when it comes to gelatin and fish gelatin, to eat it with meat products and certainly to eat it with milk products, and even meat gelatin to eat with fish products. Also, they're makel on that too. So, bottom line, where do we stand? I think it'll be quite hard now for you to find a kosher product with non-kosher gelatin in it. If what Weidman said is correct, it's going to be more or less a thing of the past. But nevertheless, it's an interesting discussion, and I think hopefully setting it out on the page here will make it clear. Next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, we get into our cheese and wine tasting procedure. Next week, cheese, the week after, wine. And also when it comes to wine, the very interesting controversial issue of who can pour your wine. And there was a lot of issues with that in the north in the wineries, and we'll talk about that in a couple of weeks, please. Thank you.